I, as a kind of son of children sitting in incoherent programming, went to the law school. So we had the conference taking place as a matter of passing, or maybe as a matter of, I would say, remembrance, because I regard academia as being still my home, even though I may be in Parliament. Parliament is a temporary sojourn for me, but having been a law student and a law professor, that's really my home. That's where I feel at home. That's why I'm so delighted to be here today. I should share with you a certain anecdote which has become legendary in my family. That's why I'm in reference to the computer. I happen to be, and I must make full disclosure, this is at the outset, though, I'm sure this will undermine my credibility when I do this, particularly among younger people. I happen to be technically illiterate. I don't know how emails work, computers, videos, and the like. Well, my son, who's 23 years of age now, when he was three, he apparently had a prescient understanding that I didn't know how any of these things worked. So he came to me one day with that impish grin, which remains his trademark, and he looked up and he said, "Daddy, can you help me fix the video?" And I said to him, "Well, you know, I don't know how to fix the video." And he looked at me and said, "I know that. All I'm asking to do is to pick me up because I can't reach it." Later that day, my daughter came to me and she said, "Daddy, you know what Yoni told me?" And I said, "No." He said, she told me, "Gila, Daddy may be a nice man. He's not very smart." So that should be the appropriate response to the very normal supernatural that I received. So I'm delighted to be able to be here and to participate in the common cause which brings us together. But I would take to be the struggle against exclusion, the struggle against discrimination, against inequality, against disability, against racism, and this as part of the larger struggle, part of the larger struggle for human rights, for human dignity, and for international justice. In a word, and in the thematic words of the conference, for making equal rights real. And that found and fine expression in the early words of my father's teachings to me. He was really my first law teacher. And as soon as I could barely begin to understand language and meaning, he would teach me about the importance of what he would call, in terms of the biblical imperative, as he put it, of justice, justice, shall you pursue. And as I grew older, you know, he would speak to me about the fact that the pursuit of justice was equal to all the other commandments combined. But this, as he put it, was the intergenerational legacy. This is what one would have to teach, you know, from one generation to another. And as my mother would be wont to add always to that, and she would say, "But if you want to pursue justice, you have to feel the injustice about you. You have to go in and about the community and feel the injustice. Otherwise, the pursuit of justice is just an abstraction. Otherwise, it's just a theoretical imperative. You have to go into the trenches and witness the injustice. Only then will you be able to act with respect to combating that injustice in the pursuit of justice." And these words resonated for me when I was sworn in as Minister of Justice, and we were ushered out into the proverbial media scrum where the objective is not so much to secure information, but in fact maybe to embarrass and the like. And we had the media scrum, and before the questions were put to me, and almost as if my parents' words were resonating for me, I said at the time that I would be guided in my work as minister by one overarching principle, and that was the pursuit of justice. And within that, the promotion and protection of equality. Of equality as not just another right, however important that is, within the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedom, but equality as an organizing principle for the building of a just society, and for the promotion and protection of human dignity, for the building of a society that is not only just, but one that would be compassionate and humane. And so I then said to myself in the early days of ministry, that if I wanted to give expression to the pursuit of justice, to implement this imperative, but also to recall the importance of understanding and feeling the injustice, I ought to go in and about the country and meet not only with my provincial and territorial ministerial counterparts, not only with people in the regional offices of the Department of Justice, not only with judges and law schools and law students and what, but I ought to go in and amongst the people, to go in and amongst the Aboriginal peoples, to meet with women's groups, to meet with different disadvantaged groups, and go and see and witness where the people themselves were feeling that injustice, and what was their voice, and what was it that they were trying to convey to government, in order that I could help develop a justice agenda. And wherever I went, the question I would put would be, if you were the Minister of Justice, what would your priorities be? And how would you seek to implement these priorities? And how can we work together in order to help implement a justice agenda? As it happened, the first meeting I had, even before I was able to embark on this, I could call it, Cross Canada Justice set of encounters, first meeting I had was with a group of Aboriginal law students from Akitsa, the first ever Aboriginal law school, Akitsa Law School in Nunavut, who had come to Ottawa almost coincident with the time that I became Minister of Justice, and arranged to have a meeting. And I'll never forget that encounter, because that encounter, in terms of having a sense of injustice, having a sense of injustice, has indelibly impacted and imprinted itself on my psyche, and thereby, hopefully, on the policies that we pursue. And I still recall the words where they said, when they said, Scott, we're not just law students. We're Aboriginal law students. We come with a history, a heritage, a culture, a spirituality, with an identity, our languages, with our own indigenous legal tradition. And we've been dispossessed from all that. We've been dislocated from our land, from our history and our heritage and our culture and our identity and our language, from our own indigenous legal tradition. And it's not that we go to court, because we want to continuously pursue a grievance. We go to court because we want to reaffirm who we are. We go to court because we want to reconnect to our Aboriginal roots. We go to court because we want to give expression to our Aboriginal identity. And whatever we do, we feel a great sense of pain, because we feel that the Canadian government and the Canadian people don't understand who we are, where we've come from, and what we aspire to be. And so I then said to them that I would share with them a parable that comes out of my tradition, but out of different traditions. And it's where the students go to their rabbi and they say, Rabbi, we love you. And the rabbi says, do you know what hurts me? And the students say, Rabbi, why do you ask us? We know what hurts you. We tell you we love you. And the rabbi says, because if you don't know what hurts you, you can't tell me you love me. That, for me, is a profound principle of human relationships. But as I said to them, it would be the principle, in respect of which I would relate, and hopefully our government would relate, the Aboriginal peoples, and which underpins really the three case studies that I want to share with you, and I'm sure I'll get through all three. The three case studies that I want to share with you, referencing the overarching theme of this conference of making equal rights real. What are the mechanisms and the strategies to implement, if you will, the principles and perspectives of equality rights? And so let me begin with the Aboriginal justice, because after that encounter with the Aboriginal students, that which I had felt growing up, and you never know how life's experiences influence you. I was a very young boy. Our family had rented a summer cottage in Kanawaki, and so I used to spend summers there. And so Aboriginal traditions and sensibilities were something I encountered, you know, as a young boy. And you never know how these things later on, you know, find expression. And certainly, as a law professor, Aboriginal justice was one of the areas of my teaching. But given this encounter and the encounters that I had in visiting Aboriginal groups across this country, it became clear to me that Aboriginal justice had to be not only a priority on the justice agenda, but it had to be a defining issue of whom we were and what we had to do. Fortunately, this coincided with the government priorities at the time. The government that I became a minister in, the government of Paul Martin at the time, in our first cabinet meeting, and you can appreciate maybe the kind of psychological connectedness I felt, when the Prime Minister said at the first cabinet meeting that our relationships with the Aboriginal people will be the legacy issue of this government. It will define who we are, and thereby set in place, you know, institutional mechanisms for that purpose at the governmental level. In other words, the question of Aboriginal justice, if you will, was identified as a whole of government priority, not just that of the Minister of Justice, not just that of the Minister of Indian Affairs, but a whole of government priority to be mainstreamed throughout the government. And certain mechanisms were set up for that purpose, such as the first ever cabinet secretariat on Aboriginal affairs, the first ever cabinet committee on Aboriginal justice on which I sat, etc. So you have the mainstreaming of this in an institutional and strategic sense with respect to the priorities of government. But it clearly was not enough to just have it in a whole of government priority. I had to define it as well as an Aboriginal justice priority for the justice agenda, and sought to frame it around what I called the seven R's of Aboriginal justice, which happily were then adopted by the cabinet, read into the parliamentary record, and repeated in every encounter that I had with the Aboriginal groups in this country. In fact, it came from those meetings. The appreciation and identification of what those seven R's were. And very quickly, the first R was the recognition of the Aboriginal peoples as the original inhabitants of this country, as an important symbolic as well as substantive approach. Second, respect for the Aboriginal peoples with regard to their distinguishable legal and constitutional status in this country, as set forth in Section 25 of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms and Section 35 of the Constitution. The third R was redress. Redress for past wrongs inflicted on the Aboriginal people, particularly the disgraceful residential school legacy. The fourth R was representation, or the double entendre, the double meaning of representation. The plight of the over-representation of Aboriginal people as inmates in our criminal justice system and the like. And the other side, the under-representation of Aboriginals as judges, as prosecutors, as lawyers, and the like. The fifth R was the importance of responsiveness. By responsiveness, we meant that government decision-making had to be in consultation with and in response to and appreciation of the whole gamut of Aboriginal history, sensibilities, aspirations, and the like. And we even constitutionalize this in a sense in terms of our interventions in court cases, which gave rise to court judgments to the effect that governments could not arbitrarily or unilaterally regulate matters respecting Aboriginal title and land, but without the obligation of consultation with the Aboriginal people. The sixth R was reconciliation. In other words, if we would incorporate, implement the first five R's, recognition and respect and redress and representation and responsiveness, then we would arrive at the sixth R, which was reconciliation. And with reconciliation, we can move forward to authentic renewal. And so those were the seven R's of Aboriginal justice and really underpinning our government relationship. But again, it was not enough even to have a framing of the Aboriginal justice issue in terms of the seven R's. We have to seek to give effect to it through strategies and mechanisms, the kinds of things that you're speaking about here. What were to be the policies? What were to be the agreements? What were to be the legislation? What were to be the initiatives? What would be the strategies and mechanisms to bring this about? Now, time does not permit me to go into this. I could go on at length at each one of these initiatives. I'm only going to name them, because, as I say, time does not permit. And I'll just name only, four or five. The first was an unprecedented process of discussions and consultations, and when I see the time frame, I'm already realizing not only not have both of the three priorities, we're not getting any one of them. Let me just say very quickly. There was a historic process of discussion negotiations that began with an Aboriginal roundtable between our federal government, ministers, etc., and representatives of the Aboriginal people, the five distinct Aboriginal entities that came before us, as well with us, Inuit, Métis, and like that. This led to, a historic, a political accord, and indeed an individual accord with each of the five Aboriginal groups, and all the way to the Kelowna Accords, which took place in November 2005, the first ever Aboriginal roundtable, an Aboriginal summit, because the government began in May 2004, so 3 months after we were formed as a government, to give a sense in which we tried to move quickly. And then it all led to the Kelowna Accords of 2005, a setting, identification of six priorities with respect to Aboriginal people's health, education, economic development, employment, land treaties, and the like, and a close to $6 billion budget for that purpose. So that was the first initiative. I'll just, in one word, call it the Kelowna, the process towards the Kelowna Accord. The second was the historic agreement respect a just and lasting solution to the residential school's legacy. That too came about in November 2005, and I recall saying at the time that there are moments in public life that make everything worthwhile. And that agreement, in the presence of Phil Fontaine, Grand Chief of the National Assembly, First Nations at the time, Aboriginal leaders, and the like, we arrived at that agreement with respect to addressing and redressing what Phil Fontaine had called the most disturbing racist incident in Canadian history. I won't go through the components of it, but it was a very comprehensive agreement. It was not just in terms of indemnification, it was setting up processes for healing, for truth and reconciliation, for alternative dispute resolution mechanisms, and like, again, along the lines of what you're thinking about strategies and mechanisms. The third initiative that we had was we established a joint negotiating committee from the government and the Aboriginal peoples with respect to seeing how we could go away from litigation, away from an adversarial process, to a consultative process with respect to the resolution of the Aboriginal land claims and treaty claims and the like. I sat on that behalf of the government. Again, this came about in November 2005. All that is interesting because about 5 days after all these things were concluded, the government fell. And when the Conservative government came in, much of this, regrettably, was scrapped. I don't want to be parted on this. I'm just speaking in terms of what occurred at the time and what has been lamented as well by the Aboriginal people. A fourth initiative was the Declaration on the Rights of of Indigenous Peoples, this was the International Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which we supported and which we were engaged in negotiating with other governments to bring about. Regrettably, when the Conservative government came in, they reversed the position, opposed the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and so, frankly, until 2 months ago, to get this thing back in step and get the government back in step to have Canada be where it should have been, not only supporting it, but helping to bring other governments along. And finally, to ensure that the whole question of Aboriginal justice was on every meeting, every bilateral meeting that I would have with my justice counterpart, or every meeting that I would have with the federal, the annual federal meeting of federal provincial meetings of justice, ministers of justice. Okay, let me go on very quickly now. The second core case study about making equality rights real, and that has to do with the whole question of same-sex marriage, of equal access of gays and lesbians to civil marriage. This can only be understood within the framework of the revolutionary developments in Canadian constitutional law. I don't want to turn this into an academic discourse on that, other than to say that the adoption of the Constitution Act in 1982, the centerpiece was the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, had a transformative and even revolutionary impact, and not only on our laws, but on our lives, not only on how we taught law, but on how people lived law. Simply put, in the first 115 years of our Constitution, which is only about the in one line, the whole of Canadian constitutional history, if you made any inquiry into it, you would see that it revolved around what may be called the powers process, the distribution of power between the federal government and the provinces, as distinct from the rights process, namely the limitations on the exercise of power, whether federal or provincial. Therefore, any rights issue came before the courts, as the former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Canada, Bora Laskin, put it. The question always was for the judges, which of the two levels of government has the power to work the injustice? Not whether the injustice itself, you know, can be redressed. The Charter of Rights and Freedoms and Constitution Act transformed all this. We went from being a parliamentary democracy to a constitutional democracy. We went from the sovereignty of Parliament to the sovereignty of the Constitution. We went from judges being arbiters of legal federalism with the power process to judges being the guarantors of individual and group rights, not because the judges assumed that power on their own, because the Constitution, and at least Parliament, gave them that power. Individuals and groups went from being passive objects of whatever the power process was designed for them to being rights claimants with a panoply of rights and remedies that were hitherto, you know, almost unanticipated in terms of the dramatic achievement. We went from rights being non-justiciable, not even being able to speak about them, as being constitutionalized. And this brings the whole same sex, the prohibition of discrimination on grounds of sexual orientation. And we went in terms of people having standing to be able to bring the claims before the court. If you didn't have it, that's why I went into this quick snapshot of this background. If you didn't have this revolutionary act, if you didn't have this Charter of Rights and Freedoms, if you didn't have the prohibition in our Constitution of discrimination on grounds of sexual orientation, you could not have moved toward the process of equal access of gays and lesbians to civil marriage. And that process, which I regard as one of the most dramatic, you know, processes in Canadian history, in a very quick snapshot of what that process was, it began really with a government discussion paper with respect to a proposal for equal access to gays and lesbians to civil marriage. There were hearings across the country, hundreds and hundreds of witness testimonies. From that, individuals and groups in this country who now have standing in order to give effect to went before the courts to say that the prohibition of discrimination on grounds of sexual orientation now had to include equal access to civil marriage. And so the matter went before the courts with hearings across this country, and nine courts in our nine provincial courts in this country affirmed the rights of gays and lesbians to equal active as a civil matter. The matter then went back, as in effect there, where it still resided, with government and parliament, and we as a government decided to refer the matter to the Supreme Court of Canada for an advisory opinion. A, to get the views of the appellate court of Canada. Secondly, to short-circuit this process so we wouldn't need to have protracted litigation that remained, uncertain in terms of how long and what might be the result. We framed the questions before the court. The hearing was held before the court with 28 intervenants from across the country. This was, civil society, if you will, giving expression to their rights and coming before the court. The Supreme Court, in a unanimous decision, but because it was a reference, it was only an advisory opinion, held that equal rights to same-sex marriage not only was compatible with the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, but flowed from it. Because it was an advisory opinion and came back to the government, we then enacted the legislation that brought about, the same-sex marriage legislation in this country and made Canada the fourth country in the world, to make equal rights real in the matter of equal rights for gays and lesbians at the civil law. This was, I have to tell you, fraught with a lot along the way, with a lot of pain, with a lot of division, with a lot of adversariness. But as I said at the time, that once we adopt this legislation, we will see that the sky will not fall, the earth will not open up, but we will give equal rights to those who have been thus far disadvantaged. I know I see my time. I just want to give a Sherry a quick vignette with this, and I'll close the second point, and then we quickly turn maybe the third. And abuse was another several issues on the important issue of women. But just to tell you how these things were painful along the way, because really, same-sex marriage resulted from the encounter between government and parliament and the courts and civil society and rights claimants and the media and the like. And I had an encounter. I was asked to meet with a group of rabbis across this country. They were very disturbed by this stand that I was taking on the matter of same-sex marriage. And I sought to convey to them that the same-sex legislation was anchored in two foundational principles: the equality rights principle and the freedom of religion principle. Freedom of religion principle meant that nothing would thereby change for the religious denominations were opposed. All it would do would be to give rights to those who did not have it. I don't believe that it, at the time, acted as any palliative to tell them that as well. 2 weeks later, I was meeting with a very large group of Muslims in a mosque in my ride. And I had a usual discussion with them, and one got up and said, "No, that's how I want to say, for the most part, we don't have, difficulties with your policy, like, except for one thing." And I said, "What is that?" They said, "Same-sex marriage. We didn't ever consider that when we would come here, we would have same-sex marriage." So I said, "No, I have to tell you." I said, 2 weeks ago, I met with a group of rabbis. They brought up the same concern in the same way. I said, "You have to admit that at least on this issue, I dropped the dream." But as I say, the sky never opened, and equality rights in that regard were secured. We made equal rights real with the help and really with the initiative of the rights claimants in this country. Which brings me to the last one that I want to make, and that's women's rights. Because we're meeting really a historic moment of remembrance and reminder in a matter of women's rights. On the 100th anniversary of the founding of International Women's Day in Copenhagen, on the 15th anniversary of the Beijing Declaration and all its initiatives in the matter of women's rights. But I have to tell you, the thing that impacted on me was 2 years before the Beijing Declaration, in 1993, I went to the Vienna Conference, the first conference on human rights that had been held in 25 years, international conference held in Vienna. And what emerged as a clarion call in that conference, although it's always credited to Hillary Clinton in the Beijing Declaration and her remarks there 2 years later, and I credit her with having taken up that clarion call. The clarion call that energized the Vienna Conference on Human Rights, that women's rights are human rights, and there are no human rights which do not include the rights of women, that found expression at that Vienna Conference. And what was interesting is that clarion call energized not only the cause of women's rights, but in
the cause of human rights across this country. I regret to say that 15 or 17 years later, women's rights are still not human rights. Human rights still do not include, in terms of gender equality, the rights of women. What UNESCO then said at the time in 1993 still holds true, that women, the gender inequality is a form of gender apartheid. And so, as a government, what we sought to do, and this I do much more in my law professor's work, is we tried to, and I won't go into we tried to identify what were the 10 indices of women's inequality. What were the 10 indices of gender inequality? And what were the strategies and mechanisms to bring them about? I mean, some of those indices were things like, you know, equal voice, the absence of equal representation for women in parliament and decision-making bodies across this country. This is not just a theoretical thing. I can tell you, as somebody who's a member, first the only male member of the women's caucus, won't go into how that happened, but on a personal level, the interesting thing about it is when I sat in on those meetings, the discourse in the women's caucus were about real issues and how to make those real equality rights issues real. And so we would discuss health care issues, and we would discuss child care issues, and we discussed early learning issues. We discussed, and we, you know, violence against, we would discuss the things that Parliament should be discussing. And you know what we found, bless you, you know what we found in Perth? I looked into it after. Those parliaments that have a greater percentage of women as members of their parliament in Norway, like 40% moved to Matt, have more in the matter of social policy legislation. Because the women's voice, it's not just a matter of a kind of gender equity in terms of representation in parliament, it's a matter of giving equal voice to those issues, which then become matters of public policy. And so the indices were equal voice was one, the second had to be equal pay for work of equal value, the third was the question of income security, we had the importance of a housing policy, we had the importance of early learning and child care, and that was a ramp to equality, combating violence against women, because violence against women was really targeting the vulnerability of women who were unequal to begin with, and therefore inequality invited violence, violence begets inequality. And then we went on to the international scale. One of the first pieces of legislation that I introduced as a minister was to combat trafficking in persons, because trafficking is even a whole new global sex trade and slavery at this point, in terms of trading in persons. And it's the fastest growing criminal industry in the world. Trafficking in persons. And so we made the question of trafficking in persons, of protecting women in armed conflict, whether it be in the Congo and Darfur, and the like, a priority in the international justice agenda, and seeking to set up mechanisms for that. So that was the third case study in terms of making equal rights real. And so I will end up, if I may, just where I began. And that was the not only the teaching, but the admonition of my parents of blessed memory, that if you want to make equal rights real, it isn't only a matter of pursuing justice and pursuing those people. It's a matter of feeling the pain of the disadvantaged. And then having that kind and bearing that kind of witness, then seeking to institutionalize forms of rights protection through a whole framework of legislation and agreements and strategies and mechanisms on the domestic and international levels. And it won't be done in one generation. That's why, from generation to generation, you're the ones who are really now, I would say, the legatees and the trustees of making equal rights real. Thank you.